We're studying the miracles of Jesus, the works of Jesus, and last week we saw Jesus preach the first time in his hometown. He came back to Galilee, he'd been down in the south, and then he came back up to his hometown in Galilee there, and for the first time he preached and at his home synagogue there, and the people just loved his sermon. They ate it up. They were thrilled about it. And he claimed to be the Messiah, the one who would bring all the promises of Isaiah 61, and they loved that. And they're all set to start following him until he got to the illustrations in his sermon where he made the point that the blessings promised in Isaiah 61 were going to the Gentiles because the Jews would reject him, Jesus, the Messiah. And so the blessings would pass over them and go to the Gentiles. When Jesus got to that point in his sermon, they responded with unmitigated rage. They flipped out and they tried to murder him. They dragged him brutally out of town and they were going to throw him over a cliff and stone him to death and kill him. They got so upset. And you remember the miracle part was very quiet. It's a fascinating miracle. The way Jesus chose to escape from that situation was, it says he just passed through their midst. He let that plan get pushed all the way right up to the brink of where they were going to derail God's plan. And at that point, it always stops because God's plan can never be derailed. And so Jesus said, okay, stop. That's all. You can't go any farther. We're going to kill you. We're going to murder you. No. I'm leaving now. Goodbye. Excuse me. Pardon me. Coming through. And I don't know what those people were thinking when he's just walking right through their midst. But, you know, Jesus, when he came into this world, veiled himself with humanity and he became a man. But he was also always 100% almighty sovereign God. And when he decided something wasn't going to happen or was going to happen, that was it. There's something about the commanding presence and the authority of the sovereign king of the universe that just froze those people in their tracks and they couldn't move. Well, so then he leaves there and he goes to the other towns to preach. Now, have you noticed, ever since we've been back in Galilee, we haven't heard anything of the disciples? Where are the disciples? Whatever happened to the disciples? I mean, they're following him all over the place. Every single story is all, you know, it says the disciples did this and the disciples responded this way. Now, all of a sudden, we're back in Galilee, where the disciples are from, and they're gone. Every story, remember that? All the way back to the nobleman's son? Jesus, just Jesus. Where did those guys go? Well, the answer is in Mark 1:16. Jesus is traveling around preaching, and he decides to preach a sermon over at the Sea of Galilee. And I've got some pictures here. Last time I had pictures, I forgot to talk about them. But this time I've got... Anyway, these are just some photos of the Sea of Galilee that you're going to see in a minute. And it's a beautiful area. And Jesus decides to go over there and preach a sermon. And he's walking along the sea. And Mark 1:16 says he saw Simon and his brother Andrew casting a net into the lake. They're fishing. That's where they went. They went back to their old job. They went back fishing. They've been following Jesus for about a year now. And all around the southern area, and then they get back to their own home area up in the north where they're from, and they just go back. See, these were small business owners. They had a fishing business, and they had left it for about a year. And in their thinking, they were thinking that they had signed up apparently for a kind of a short-term mission, just a one-year deal, and then they went back to their job. And so they're fishing. And it says they're casting these nets. And by the way, let me just throw in a little note that I think you're going to find interesting here. They're casting their nets. The word there for nets, amphibolo, it's a net, it's a casting net. It's an 8-foot diameter circular net, perimeter weighted, with lead weights around the perimeter. And you'd throw that thing, and it was a skilled deal. It's kind of like throwing a lasso. And you just stand there on the beach. This is just personal fishing, just for catching one or two fish. This is just like we would do with a rod and reel. And they're there on the net, the shore, and they would find like a school of fish, and they'd try and throw that thing over and catch a fish or two. It had a rope around the perimeter tied to their wrist, and they'd just pull it in and get the fish. The disciples are there doing that. It's interesting. The reason I point that out is because you look down a little ways and it says, when Jesus said, follow me, it says that once they left their nets and followed him. That's a totally different word for nets. That's nituon. And that word means that they left their big, huge, commercial, 100-foot-long, semicircular fishing, commercial fishing nets. Now, why the two different? It says they're casting these one kind of nets, and then when it says they left their nets, it says a different thing. And the critics have said, well, see, that's because these aren't really eyewitness accounts. Guys like Mark, what they did was they found a few sources over here and grabbed a few oral traditions, and they pieced together some things that they found, hodgepodge, and kind of cut and pasted it together. And that's how they came up with the Gospels. It's not really a reliable historical account. And things like this are evidence of that. The words don't really match up. Well, what do we have to say to that? Actually, not only does that not prove that this is an unreliable account, but the fact that these two different words are used is strong evidence that this was from an eyewitness account. Let me fill you in, and you'll see in a minute why that is. But let's just kind of move along here. In verse 17, Jesus said, "Come and follow me, and I will," and this is a famous thing, "I will make you fishers of men." Now, I've heard that all my life. "I'll make you fishers of men." You know, I used to sing that as a kid in Sunday school. "I'll make you fishers of men." Remember that little song? Do you get excited about that? "I will make you fishers of men." I don't know what you think about that. I have to be honest with you. I've never been very excited about that particular promise in the Bible. Be fishers of men. Fishing is okay if you're there with, you know, if you're in a pretty place or if you can just relax in a chair or whatever. But comparing fishing to ministry has just never gotten me very excited. My idea of fishing, you know, I sit there, I cast the thing out, I wait, nothing much happens, and I'm staring. And finally I get bored, so I reel it in, and sure enough, it's just a hook, so I put some more bait on there, and throw that back out, reel it back in, put some more bait, and basically it's just a fish feeding deal. I never really catch much of anything, it seems like. And so, I never really thought much about this promise, but until I studied this and found out that Jesus did not intend for anybody to think of that when he said, "I will make you fishers of men." These guys were not people who were out there with a rod and reel. These were commercial fishermen. This was their job, commercial fishermen. They were used to catching fish literally by the tons. And Jesus said that to this group, "I will make you fishers of men." They were fishermen. And this job, being a fisherman, by the way, was no picnic. It was a very strenuous job, and dangerous. It is back-breaking work. They'd go out at night. In the daytime, the fish were too deep, and they couldn't catch anything. They had to go out at night. And they would put their boats out into the deep water in the middle of the night. They didn't have lights, obviously, and they had to work in the dark, and they had the dictuon nets. They're over 100 feet long, semicircle. They would bring the boats around, and those things were perimeter weighted too, and they'd fall down over top of these huge schools of fish, and then they would pull in with these huge ropes, hand over hand, pull these nets back in the boat. Very difficult work. You imagine a soaking wet 100-foot-long rope, and then all the fish and debris and stuff that they would catch as well. And they'd haul those things in, and then empty it all out, and then do the whole thing over again, and they just keep doing that over and over all night long. Bad job. It was hard work. Only strong, courageous men could do this job, but it was a good paying job. It paid better than average for a job at that time. And it was successful work. I mean, if you just let those nets down, they caught huge numbers of fish. The Sea of Galilee is jammed full of fish. It was then, it is now. In fact, Easton's Bible Dictionary says, "There is probably no other sheet of water in the world of equal dimensions with such a variety and profusion of fish. It is just loaded with fish." And it was a very successful enterprise. They would just drop these things over the huge schools of fish, haul them all in, and just keep filling up their boats and filling up their boats and filling up. And then finally morning would come, and when morning came and the market opened, whatever they had, they would go to the shore, they would cart off all those fish off to the market and sell them. They were into sales. That's how they made their living. And I don't know how many fish they would catch on an average day, but they would have to catch enough and sell enough to cover their overhead and then make a profit. That's the way a small business works. And they had a lot of overhead because they had a whole staff, we find from this passage, a whole crew that worked with them, their whole family. They had to feed their families. They had to pay the wages of their whole staff. And they had to, the constant upkeep of all the equipment. And there's a lot of expenses involved. And if you ever run a small business, you know that the profit margin is pretty slim. So the way it worked, I mean, I don't know how many fish they'd have to catch. Suppose they took, you know, had to catch, say, 1,000 fish a night to cover their expenses. If they caught 1,000 fish, then that would just cover their expenses. Anything more than that would be profit that they could sell. Anything less than that would be a disaster because then they wouldn't even meet their expenses. So that's what their job was, and they went back to that work. But that's not all there was to their job. After the fish were sold in the morning came the grueling part of putting everything away. I was reading about this, very tedious process, but important. They'd probably get some breakfast, and then after going to the market, and then they would have the process of cleaning out whatever debris got tangled in the nets, which happened, and then they would work on mending them. They didn't have the nylon ropes like we have today. They had ropes that they made, and they would break, and they had to mend the nets and clean them all out. And then, after all that, if you imagine working all night, working very, very hard all night, and then sitting there on the beach with the morning sun kind of shining on you, sitting mending your nets, and maybe nodding off a little bit, you're probably real tired. Well, then they had to get themselves up, drag those nets over to where the rocks were, spread them over rocks, and let them dry. And these pictures, by the way, are actually the Sea of Galilee today. But they would let them dry, and after they were dry, then they would go through the process of folding them all up a certain way and then loading them all back in the boats, and you get everything all ready for the next night of work. Then, only then, after all that, could they finally go home and get some rest before the next night. But not this day. They're not going to get any rest. Verse 16. Jesus walked beside the Sea of Galilee, saw Simon and his brother Andrew casting a net into the lake, Amphibolo net. These guys are standing there on the shore, casting one of these little casting nets, trying to catch a few fish. You say, well, wow, after a whole night of commercial fishing, now they're doing that? How greedy are these guys? I mean, they just caught all these thousands of fish, and now they got to catch five more? I mean, man, talk about dedicated fishing. Well, no, it's not that they're greedy. Why were they doing this? Well, Luke 5. Luke gives us the same story. And in Luke 5, you may want to turn there, he gives us a little more details. And he says, in verse 5, Peter says, we worked hard all night and haven't caught anything. The reason they're casting those casting nets in the morning is because they fished all night. They didn't. Not only did they not meet their expenses, they didn't catch anything. I mean, they didn't catch 1,000 or 1,500. They didn't catch 700 or 800. They didn't even catch 300. They didn't catch 50. They didn't even catch 10. They didn't catch one single fish all night long with commercial nets. The reason they're out there with their casting nets is they need some breakfast. I mean, forget about their salary. They don't even have food to feed their family that day. They're just trying to get something. You know, there is no explanation, no natural explanation for this. This is unbelievable. They would fish all night in the Sea of Galilee with professional fishermen with huge nets and not catch one single fish. There's no natural explanation for that. That is, folks, a miracle. Jesus Christ redirected the fish and made those fish swim away from those nets all night long. That's the only explanation. And they must have thought they were in the twilight zone or something. Time after time, they'd pull those things in, and there wasn't one single. And they'd say, where are there holes in these nets? What's going on here? Well, Jesus comes along, and here they are casting these casting nets. Now, and they're doing all this work. It also says that they were preparing their nets. It means they were going through that whole process they went through in the morning. And that would be a little bit easier, I think, after a successful night of fishing. It would probably be a little more easy to make yourself do all that work. But after this particular night, can you imagine the lack of motivation that they might have and working to get all these nets ready for another night of that same thing they just done? with zero success. In fact, Peter says they worked hard. Fascinating word. The word translated worked hard in verse 5 implies difficulty and trouble in the work resulting in exhaustion and discouragement. In fact, it's so connected with the concept of discouragement that in Revelation 2:3, that same exact word is translated discouraged. The word means to work to the point of discouragement. They're just discouraged. I mean, I guess you do everything in your power to do something and you don't get one single result. That is discouraging. They're down. They're exhausted. They're frustrated and tired. And now they have all the worst part of their job. They have to clean the nets up. I mean, it's not actually true that they caught nothing. They didn't catch any fish, but they got debris in there. You know, there's a wagon wheel and some sandals and junk tangled in there. They got to get out of there. And they got to mend them. I mean, on top of that, they ripped their nets. Can you imagine that? They ripped their equipment. They didn't even get any fish. Now they're trying to fix that. And oh, what a terrible night. And then Jesus comes along and says, hey, I'll make you fishing. Guess what? I'm going to call you to a ministry that's just like fishing. Seemed like a kind of a strange time for Jesus to say that. Well, the thing you have to know is the middle part of the story. I told you the beginning part and I told you the end. Now I'll tell you the middle. This is the worst way to tell a story, but this is the way it goes. Because there's one more thing we need to know. On this particular morning, the monotony of cleaning up the nets and doing all that stuff was broken up a little bit, at least, because Jesus was there and he was preaching a sermon on the beach. And it was kind of a problem. The people were, there's so many people, masses always gathered around to hear Jesus, and he's standing there on the beach, and people in the back, they can't see, and the people are trying to look around, and so Jesus arranges for everyone to be able to see. He gets out on a boat and goes out in the water a little bit so his voice can carry and so that everyone can see and listen. He arranges for people to be able to hear. And so there he's preaching. Imagine old Peter there, sitting there trying to listen to this sermon after a hard night of hard back-breaking work and discouraged, sitting on the beach in the sun. And you can imagine the difficulty of listening to a whole sermon that way. If you've ever stayed up all night on Saturday and come to church, then you know exactly what that's like, right? Sometimes it's not easy even if you do get some sleep. But for Peter, imagine he's probably halfway comatose here. Maybe in a daze, just sitting there motionless. But suddenly, he hears his own name. And that always wakes you up. Like if I said one of your names, you'd probably perk up right now. Kathy. See? Anyway, he hears his name. And Jesus said it. And here comes Jesus giving him a command that seems absolutely unreasonable. Verse 4. Simon, put out into deep water and let down the nets for a catch. Now, can you imagine that? You've just done all this work. You know, now you want me to get my whole crew, my exhausted, discouraged, tired, angry crew that I can't pay today, and tell them to take all these nets that they finally have all prepared for the next night, and load it back in the boat, load everything back in the boats, go out into the deep water and do this whole thing again? How long would that take? How long did it take them last night? It took them all night, right? So how long would it take if you start in the morning? All day. Then what? Think about what Peter's thinking here. Okay, I have to do this, go back all day. I'm totally exhausted. We're all exhausted. We're going to go back and do the same thing all day. And we know we're not going to have any success then because there's no fish. We proved that last night. Plus, you don't catch any fish in the daytime because that's the worst time to fish because they're all too deep. Then what? Come back in the evening and clean the nets and repair them and dry them and fold them and do all that whole process so that we can go out for another shift at night? Three shifts in a row? Wow. Sounds a little bit unreasonable. But look at Peter's response in verse 5. Peter answered, Master, we have worked hard to the point of discouragement all night and haven't caught anything, but because you say so, I will let down the nets. I'll obey. Isn't that great? What a terrific response. Some people have tried to say Peter was real reluctant and whatever. It doesn't say that. It just says he obeyed. You know, Peter isn't always the best example. I mean, sometimes Peter really flops, but this time he shines. This is terrific. He obeys. He absolutely does not understand this one bit. He is a professional fisherman. This carpenter from the inland is telling him to go out and fish the wrong time of day when everything. He doesn't question it one bit. He says, because you say it, I'll do it. That's it. And Peter's the boss. He says, guys, let's go. Amazing. This is the kind of obedience that God rewards. Unquestioning, instantaneous, okay, you say it, I'll do it. I don't even understand it. And if you obey God before you understand why He's telling you to do it, that is wonderful obedience, because what is that? That's faith. If you are the type that you only obey God when you can see, it makes perfect sense to you, and you can understand why, that's not faith. Sometimes God doesn't let you know why ahead of time so that He can test your faith. Well, Peter passes this test with flying colors. And so he goes out there, and they're ready for a long, grueling day of fishing. But that's not what happens. Look at verse 6. When they had done so, they caught such a large number of fish that their nets began to break. And so they signaled to their partners in the other boat to come and help them. And they came and filled both boats so full they began to sink. Can you picture this? Can you just imagine the scene, like if you were there and you're thinking this is going to be a long drudgery of just staring at water all day and pulling in ropes, and you get out there and you spread these things, and before you're even done spreading them, all of a sudden you hear this noise and just every fish in the Sea of Galilee jumps into your net. And they're just swimming into your net, and they're flopping around, and just like a fish hatchery. And you know, the instincts kick in, and Peter, he starts shouting and yelling, command, okay, you guys, oh, start pulling them. Look at all these fish, quick, let's pull these nets in. And you guys, come on over here and pull this way and get them in. We got to get these fish. Pull, 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 pull. Rip, up, stop, stop, stop. They're ripping. Okay, hold on. Let's start shoveling them in. And he signals to the other boats, come on over here, we need your help. And the other boats come over, and these are big, long boats, 27-foot long boats. They found one of them. Huge boats, and they're shoveling these fish in one boat, and they're shoveling them in the other boat, and they keep shoveling and shoveling and shoveling, and now these boats are so full, they're starting to sink. You know, fishing with Jesus, this is the same thing that happened the other time Jesus did the same miracle. After the resurrection, they tried to go back to fishing again, and He had to do the same miracle again. And the same thing happened. And that's ripped, the boats sink. Fishing with Jesus is hard on the equipment, especially the nets. Anyway, they're sinking now. You know, sometimes God's blessings are so great that they create new problems. Now they're out there sinking. I mean, it's like, I bet you. You know, here we are, we're praying that the Lord will start this church, get this church going, and bring people, and we're praying for more people and more families and more children and more workers and all this stuff, and we're asking the Lord to provide. I bet you, a year or two from now, we're going to be having different problems. We're going to be saying, Lord, what are we going to do with all these kids? We need some more classroom space. We're going to have, you know, we're meeting in the hallways and things like that. Because that's the way the Lord blesses. He just, everything's just so overabundant. Well, that's what happens here. And it's just overwhelming. I mean, it's more fish than they really need at this point here. Well, they make it. They must have let some of the fish go so they wouldn't sink. And they get to the shore. And then Peter responds in verse 8. When Simon Peter saw this, he fell at Jesus' knees. Some people have wondered, why did he fall at his knees? Well, it's because they're in a boat. They're sitting down. He's sitting, so his knees are right there. Anyway, he fell at his knees, and he said, listen to this, go away from me, Lord. I am a sinful man. For he and all his companions were astonished at the catch of fish they had taken. And so were James and John, the sons of Zebedee, Simon's partners. Go away. Please
leave.
He said that out of fear because of his sinfulness. Because he knew that his heart was exposed to this one who could read hearts. You know, when you first meet somebody, you're pretty careful around that person. You don't expose too much of yourself to them right away because you have to examine them, make a judgment. Immediately, we just do this automatically. When you meet someone, you start evaluating and you start making judgments about the person, what kind of person they are, what category they're like. You make yourself vulnerable to your friends and to your family and people you can trust. But when you first meet a stranger, we wear a little bit of armor, don't we? We have certain personalities that we sort of put on to kind of protect ourselves. You have to do that. You can get hurt. This natural reaction to evaluate people, basically, we're trying to answer the question in our mind, is this person safe or not? Some people are safe, some people are not. Some people are trustworthy, other people aren't. I mean, you can get hurt. You got to be careful about exposing yourself too much to people or you can get hurt. I mean, it's like that story I heard about these three ministers who were hitting a round of golf. And at the end of the round of golf, they sat down, they're talking, and one of them just spontaneously said, you know, guys, I have to confess something to you. I have been struggling with something. It's alcohol. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a drinker and a closet drinker. And I just can't get victory over it. I struggle with it all the time. And if my church ever found out, I'd just be finished. And the second guy says, you know, I have something to confess too. For me, it's not alcohol, it's pornography. And I struggle with it every single day. I get magazine. I try and get myself to stop, but I just, nothing helps. And not only would my ministry be in jeopardy, but my wife, if I could ruin my family with this. The third guy didn't say anything. And the first two guys said, what about you? Have any sin you struggle with that you'd like to confess? The guy says, yeah. He says, I'm a compulsive gossip and I can't wait to get out of here. So, you know, I mean, you have to be careful who you confess to. Some people are safe. Other people aren't so safe. Well, when the disciples saw Jesus do this, command the fish and the sea, and they obeyed him. And they're trying to think, what category do I put him in? They didn't have a category for this guy. He didn't fit anything they imagined. And when they're saying, is he safe? Peter realized at this moment, this is not just a miracle worker here. It's not just a prophet. This is the Lord of the fish and the Lord of fishermen and the Lord of the sea and the Lord of creation and the Lord of everything. Peter realized at that moment he was standing a foot away from Almighty God. And it terrified him. Because Almighty God is all-seeing, holy God. Holy meaning evil is consumed in his presence. And Peter has the same response that anyone ever has when they're in the presence of God in Scripture. He becomes instantaneously aware of the corruption in his heart, and he wants Jesus to leave. He can't stand it. It's like Jean-Paul Sartre. I don't know if you ever studied philosophy, but Sartre is known for a one-act drama that he wrote called No Exit. And it's a drama about hell. And basically, Sartre said, hell is like as being in a room with a whole bunch of people staring at you and never ever saying anything. Forever. That's hell. For Sartre, there is nothing, the worst thing imaginable is to be exposed to other people's gaze. And even worse than that, the worst possible imaginable thing, and this is why Sartre couldn't stand the thought that there could be a God, because he says, if there is a God, that means that I, 24 hours a day, am exposed to the unremitting gaze of a perfectly holy God all the time. That thought was so intolerable to him that he rejected it. He couldn't imagine it. He said that state of affairs can't be that bad. See, there's no more dangerous place in the world, in the universe, for a sinner than the presence of a holy God. And as humans, we have a built-in fear of God's holiness, as well we should. you want to hear something startling? And if Sark ever read this, he would have thought that David was insane. Because David in Psalm 139 wrote this. Absolutely unbelievable. Can you imagine Sark reading this? Search me, O God, and know my heart, and see if there be any wicked way in me. Now, can you imagine somebody praying a prayer like that? Asking God to examine his sinful heart? He actually knows that he's vile on the inside and he wants to be scrutinized by a holy, perfect, just God? How could that be? How could that possibly be? It's because David understood something that Sark never dreamed of. Forgiveness. You know, Romans chapters 1 through 4 talk about God's wrath over our sin, and then it talks about salvation through faith. And then chapter 5, verse 1, one of the greatest verses in all the Bible. Therefore, we have peace with God. Peace with God. That's why, as Christians, we have the opposite response. And Peter had the opposite response. The second time Jesus did the same miracle, do you remember what happened there? It was after the resurrection when Peter was convinced and fully believed. And he was a believer at that point. When he became a believer, I don't know. But at that point, I believe he definitely was. And he's in the boat and the same miracle happens. Jesus shouts from shore. They don't know who it is, but he shouts from shore. Put your net on the other side of the boat. And they're not having any success. So they put it on the other side of the boat. And then the same thing. The boat starts sinking and everything like that. And then John recognizes Jesus' voice. And he says, hey, that's the Lord. And Peter, as soon as he hears that splash, he's in the water swimming. He can't stand to be away from the Lord. He's got to be near him. Isn't that interesting? The exact opposite response. The first time, get away from me, Lord. I'm a sinful man. The second time, he's swimming. He can't even wait to paddle over there. The boat, he just has to be near Jesus. That's the difference between a forgiven heart and an unforgiven heart. The amazing truth that Christians carry around with them is the reality that the one place in the universe, and this is just ironic, but the one place in this universe where you can be totally vulnerable and safe, completely naked and exposed without fear, is in the presence of Christ, where you are welcome. Even though we have this built-in fear of God's holiness, and we know that we're sinful, we crave His presence when we are forgiven. And we want to be near Him. And we want the sin in our lives to be burned up and done away with. We want to be purified. Some of you, maybe in this room, I don't know, it could be that there's someone in this room that has no peace with God, really. And to you, I say this, you should understand that there's absolutely no escape from the holiness of God. You either find peace with God and gain that peace or never have it. Because there's no escape. You say, well, how do you gain peace with God? Well, let's see how Peter gained it. At this moment, if we go back to our story in Luke 5, Peter's standing there, he's scared to death. He wants Jesus to leave. He wants Jesus to leave because he knows he's a holy God and that Peter himself is a sinful man and that his sin is exposed to this holy God and that he deserves to be punished. So he's scared. Well, what does Jesus do? Does he give him the punishment that he deserves? Look at verse 10. No, instead of punishing him, he gives him this promise. Totally unqualified. Jesus said, he didn't, no ifs, no conditions. He said, Jesus said to Simon, don't be afraid, from now on you will be catching men. Present participle. You will be catching men, or future participle. You'll be catching men. Jesus, instead of punishing him, giving him what he deserves, calls him to a ministry and throws in a guarantee of success. And at the moment that Jesus, now understand the scene here. You got to picture this, what this was like. At the moment Jesus uttered those words, from now on you will be catching men, at that split second, all around them, Peter could barely hear what Jesus was saying because there's thousands and thousands of fish flopping all over the place. Gaping holes in the nets, and the boat's half full of water. And Jesus says, now you're going to be catching men like that. Now, do you understand the meaning of this miracle? Jesus did not do random miracles. Every miracle has a specific meaning. Do you see why Jesus did this? These guys thought they were going to follow Jesus part-time, or 1 year, and they go back to their work. And Jesus is telling them, oh, listen, you don't understand. When I called you away from your work, I called you permanently to follow me. When I said follow me, I meant follow me for the rest of your life. That's what I meant. I didn't mean 1 year and then go back to your work. Follow me. And if you disobey me, then guess what? You'll have zero success. Guess what? This profession that you were so good at before, you can't do it anymore. But when you do what I tell you to do, look at the success that you have. I have the power to do that. When Jesus was saying, hey, come on, let's go preach the gospel to the world and we'll catch men at... And they might be thinking, well, what's the guarantee? Is there any chance of success? I mean, is this just Jesus' optimism we're going on here? No, Jesus demonstrated his power to guarantee full success. When he said, I'll make you fishers of men, that's one thing. But he also said, I'll also make you catchers of men. And how much? One soul, once in a while, after you're just sitting there in a chair watching for a nibble? No. Success beyond anything you can handle. Is that what happened with Peter? What was his first sermon like? Yeah. 3,000 added to the church that day. A couple chapters later, it's up to 5,000. Can you imagine if we had a group, say, this size, and then the next week we had, a little bit bigger than this, about 120. And then the following week you have 3,120? Can you imagine the nursery situation and then like Sunday school and all the logistics? I mean, success beyond what they could deal with. That's what it's like to work for the Lord. Guaranteed success. Well, verse 11. In instant career change, they pulled up their boats on the shore, left everything and followed him. I mean, what else are they going to do? Fishing's no fun when the one who controls the fish tells you to stop fishing and redirects all the fish away from your nets. That's not going to be any good anymore. I mean, forget that job. And by the way, now Mark makes... You see how we can see that Mark's is an eyewitness account? Mark doesn't give us all these details, but it's reliable. Mark says Jesus walked up, they're casting their casting nets, and then when he said, follow me, they left their commercial nets, they left their whole profession and followed him. Makes perfect sense, doesn't it? These disciples needed to learn at this point that you cannot make a partial commitment to following Christ. Following Christ means just that, following Christ with your life. The day that you begin following Him is the last day of you choosing your own path through life. You say, but I'm a self-directed man. I mean, I'm an independent woman. I carry out my own plans in life. Isaiah 30 verse 1 says, woe to those who carry out plans that are not mine. You better not carry out your own plans in life. Woe to those, God says, who carry out plans that are not mine. You exist on this earth for a reason, and the reason is to carry out a specific plan that God has for your life. You have no business doing anything else, and there's no meaning in anything else. Just that. You say, but it's my life. No, wrong again. Jeremiah 10:23 says, a man's life is not his own. It is not for man to direct his own steps. Jeremiah 10:23. Your life belongs to Him. And these disciples realize that. So they just leave their nets and they follow Him. And they're willing. Why are they so willing? Well, Jesus just demonstrates His ability to grant guaranteed success. That's what it's like to work for the Lord. And it's like that not just for them. This isn't just a special occasion for them. The same promise comes to us. John 15:5 says, if you abide in me, you will bear a tiny bit of fruit. Right? Is that what it says? What does it say? If you abide in me, you will bear much fruit. Joshua 1:8, be faithful and you will be prosperous and successful. 1 Corinthians 3:6, Paul planted, Apollos watered, but the Lord granted the increase. God gives success. Nehemiah 2:18, the Lord of heaven will give you success. If you follow your calling in life, you will have guaranteed success. Huge success. Now, it may not be visible success. It could be delayed success. Might be that you in this lifetime never even see it, and it comes after you're dead. It could be just some success that takes place in heaven, and you won't see it until you get there. But God has a plan for your life, and if you follow His calling, you are guaranteed phenomenal, uncontrollable success. If you take any other path in life, you're guaranteed total failure. Spiritually speaking. Well, what has He called us to? Primarily, first and foremost, if you look up all the references to calling in Scripture, you'll find that we're called to salvation. We're called to follow Jesus Christ with our lives. Jesus said He came into this world to call sinners to repentance. We're all called. We're all invited. Every single human being is called. And now there are some people that believe in what's called limited atonement, that Jesus only died for a certain select group and not everyone else, and that not everyone is called to salvation. Every single person in the world is invited genuinely to salvation. Every single one. We're all called. Romans 1:5 says, we receive grace and apostleship to call people from among all the Gentiles to obedience that comes from faith. And you are also among those who are called to belong to Christ. Everyone is called to follow. And basically, what does it mean to be a Christian? If you want just a real quick definition of a Christian, it's just this. A Christian is someone who's alive to God. You know, Romans 6:11 says, count yourselves dead to sin, but alive to God. Alive to God, that means responsive to God. A Christian is someone who's responsive to God, listens to what God says and responds. A non-Christian is someone who ignores God, lives as if there were no God, and is unresponsive to God. That's the difference between a believer and an unbeliever. Believer is alive to God. He seeks God, follows God, obeys God, listens to God's word, lives as if there is a God. And every person is called to do that. And if you respond to that call, that's evidence of faith. And that's how a person is saved. And every person is called not only to be saved, but to be holy. So we all have a calling to salvation. Every single human being has a call to follow Christ and to live a holy life. But it goes a step beyond that. And we'll just close with this. We'll pick it up maybe next time with this. But you're also called to a specific task in life that's unique just to you and no one else. God designed you different than everyone else. He gave you certain characteristics because He has a certain task just for you to do and nobody else. Just for you. And that's the reason you're on this earth. Some people have wondered, why are we on this earth? Why don't we just go to heaven? We could worship better in heaven. We could understand the Bible better in heaven. We'd be more holy in heaven. Everything would be better in heaven. Well, one of the answers to that question is, the reason you're on this earth is because God has a specific task for you to complete on this earth. As soon as you're done with that, then you will go to heaven. But that task is the only source of meaning in your life. If you miss that task, your life is wasted and worthless and pointless. If you fulfill that task, you are achieving things of eternal importance and significance. You say, how do I know what the task is? Well, we'll talk about that next week. We're out of time. So don't miss it. And for those of you who have, we did a Bible study on this topic twice already. And so those of you who have sat through this twice, don't worry, because it's going to be new material. We're going to look in a little more depth, especially we're going to study the book of Proverbs and study wisdom and how to make wise decisions in life and how to make sure you're on the path that God has for you. So I hope you're looking forward to that. I certainly am.